326-1234. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids hosts AARP Foundation Tax Aid by appointment only now through April 11th. This tax preparation service is free for families and individuals of all ages. There is a meatball dinner to benefit the Bagley Senior Center Sunday, March 23rd from 11 to 2 at the Bagley American Legion. Live music by Figuring It Out follows at 2 p.m. All proceeds will go towards a new roof for the Senior Center. Heartland Symphony presents a concert Sunday, March 23rd at 2:30 at the Geechee Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd. It will feature the world premiere of Ian T. Jones' film music, a piece inspired by Radiohead. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a program about dementia Wednesday, March 26th at 1 p.m. Learn how the disease affects people and how you can make a difference in the lives of those living with it. Project Read is accepting gently used children's books at the Community Education Service Center in the former Southwest Elementary Building in Grand Rapids. Now back to Morning Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he'll talk with President Trump today by phone. He wants to hear about Trump's phone conversation yesterday with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Russian leader has said he would stop striking Ukrainian energy infrastructure for the next 30 days. But Russia has continued to fire drones into Ukraine, even hitting two hospitals overnight. In an interview last evening, Trump discussed his phone call with Putin. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
Trump says he wants an end to Russia's war in Ukraine, though his conversation with Putin did not result in that. Putin has been insisting on a stop to military aid and foreign intelligence sharing with Ukraine. In an interview with Fox News' Laura Ingraham, Trump was asked whether Putin had demanded a stop to all aid in order to reach a ceasefire deal. Trump said it didn't come up during their call.
No, he didn't. We didn't talk about aid, actually. We didn't talk about aid at all. We talked about a lot of things, but aid was never discussed.
Ukraine's president says Russia doesn't seem ready to end the war. He said his country remains open to a peace deal, but needs to be a part of the negotiations. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Israel's prime minister says any further talks for a new ceasefire deal with Hamas will only take place under fire. More than 400 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes yesterday. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports hospital records show 60% of them were women and children.
Israel's offensive, dubbed Operation Strength and Sword, began with targeted strikes killing several mid-level and senior Hamas officials. The attacks shatter a weeks-long ceasefire after talks to free Israeli hostages and permanently end the war hit an impasse. Hospitals in Gaza report that more than 170 of those killed in Israel's initial wave of bombardment have been children. It comes as hospitals are partially functioning or destroyed in Gaza, and as Israel continues to block the entry of fuel, food, medicine, and other basic goods that Gaza's 2 million people rely on for survival. Hamas says it remained committed to the initial ceasefire agreement that was supposed to lead to a lasting truce. Israel's defense minister says Hamas must understand, quote, the rules of the game have changed. Aya Batraoui, NPR News.
A federal judge has ruled billionaire Elon Musk and his cost-cutting entity Doge likely violated the U.S. Constitution when they started dismantling the U.S. Agency for International Development. Several fired workers had sued. NPR's Fatma Tianis says the judge found that Musk and his allies acted improperly.
He said that the evidence showed that, quote, Musk made the decisions to shut down USAID's headquarters and website, even though he lacked the authority to make that decision. He said that Musk and Doge team members likely violated the Constitution in multiple ways and deprived Congress of its authority to decide what to do with an agency that it created.
NPR's Fatma Tianis. This is NPR. Specialized pharmacies have been making cheaper versions of the weight loss drug Zepbound. But NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports that, as of today, they'll have to stop producing copies of Eli Lilly's blockbuster obesity medication.
For patients whose health insurance doesn't cover Zepbound, compounding pharmacies have helped them get an affordable alternative. Jackson and Christina Agar in Minnesota each lost 20 pounds on one.
It is completely life-changing to take a bite of these triggering foods and just be like, enjoy it. Say, yep, that was good. Yep. And now I'm full.
And now,
The pharmacies are allowed to make copies of brand name drugs during shortages. But on March 19th, the Food and Drug Administration says compounding pharmacies have to stop because the Zepbound shortage is over. That's left patients like the Agars scrambling. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
There's a big change coming at the Social Security Administration. Agency officials say starting March 31st, people who want to sign up for benefits or change their bank information for their checks can no longer do this on the phone. To do any of that, Americans will have to go into a Social Security office or do it online. Critics say this will immediately affect people with disabilities and older recipients. People who don't live near a Social Security office will be significantly affected, too. This is also coming as Social Security is planning to close many of its offices and lay off thousands of workers. The Trump administration says it is cracking down on fraud. Remember, this starts March 31st. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Here at KAXE, we're all about creating community. Whether it's discussing arts or music or upcoming events, we can't do what we do here at KXE without your support and your participation. And we do that by inviting others to take part in the conversation.
I really value the opportunity to speak to folks via the radio and the other media outlets because I've found that that's where people find their information the most. I can post it on Facebook or Instagram all I want, but people are coming to the show, I think, because of the communities that are built around places like KAXE. So it's just incredibly valuable opportunity to be able to talk about it and share and invite people in.
Inviting others to take part in the conversation is what makes KAXE special. Without your input and support, we wouldn't be able to do what we do here at KAXE so well. So continue showing that support by becoming a member. And you can do that by visiting our website at kaxe.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Faudel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Coming up, we'll speak with the CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is suing after the Trump administration slashed its funding.
First, Russia and Ukraine launched strikes targeting each other's infrastructure last night.
This comes hours after President Trump and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, announced a limited ceasefire in Ukraine where Putin agreed to stop targeting Ukraine's energy facilities for 30 days. That's far short of the end to fighting on land, air, and sea that the U.S. and Ukraine agreed to last week.
With us to explain where all of this stands is NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, joins us from Kyiv. So, Eleanor, a deal between Presidents Trump and Putin, what does this mean for the war in Ukraine? Will that change anything?
Well, so far nothing has changed because this is what the skies of Kyiv sounded like last night. I held my phone out our window. So you can hear the air defense shooting down drones. You know, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he's been seeking a ceasefire to end attacks on people and civilian infrastructure, not just energy infrastructure. And he said on social media that these nighttime attacks by Russia are destroying the normal life of Ukrainians. He said the fact that these attacks continued right after Trump and Putin's call showed that maximum pressure must be put on Russia for the sake of peace.
What has Zelensky said about the possible ceasefire deal and Trump's conversation with Vladimir Putin?
Well, he does not trust Putin. And there seems to be a constant fear in Ukraine now of being thrown under the bus by the Trump administration, you know, being forced to make concessions, to capitulate. Zelensky had a long online press conference with journalists last night. And clearly the length of the 2.5-hour call between Presidents Trump and Putin was unnerving for him. And he was underwhelmed by the very limited agreement that came out of it, but he tried to show optimism because he has no choice, really. Let's listen.
Якщо такий перший крок, а поки що інших кроків немає,
You know, he's saying, if this is the first step and there are no other steps so far, then let's hear the details of how to proceed, and we will. And he just said he really hopes that President Trump will be able to put as much pressure on Putin as possible.
But how far apart you think Ukraine and Russia are, you know, on the terms of a possible deal?
Well, very far apart, actually. Analysts say there will have to be major concessions on both sides. And so far, the Russian demands are maximalist. For example, Putin wants land that his army doesn't even fully control in provinces that he's already annexed and is calling Russian. That's a red line for Ukraine. And Putin has said he will only accept a deal if Ukraine stops getting military assistance from its allies. Ukraine and the EU have rejected that.
So you mentioned the EU. That's the other party in this whole thing. The rest of Europe, what are they saying?
Well, yesterday, French President Emmanuel Macron met with the Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz, and they said they will absolutely keep the military aid flowing to Ukraine. And Macron said any ceasefire must be verifiable and Ukrainians must be at the table. You know, Macron has said many times that Europe cannot let Russia win this war. Here he is speaking yesterday.
Nous continuerons de soutenir l'Ukraine face à la guerre d'agression.
He said, we will continue supporting Ukraine in this war of aggression because we know from our experience what it means to be occupied. And of course, he's talking about the Nazi occupation of France in World War II.
Yeah. You know, U.S. officials have been trying to reassure EU allies that they will be involved in any peace agreement. But the thing is, Eleanor, I mean, they haven't been. So, I mean, how do people feel about that?
Well, this is deeply shaking the continent. There's a view that Putin is stalling so he can continue the war and that he's playing with Trump, who Europeans believe is naive, has no experience with Putin, and wants a peace deal so badly he'll do anything. The former French ambassador to the U.S. went on French TV last night, Gérard Araud, and he sort of summed up the sentiment. He said Putin is just signing on to the peace deal not to annoy Trump, but he's testing the waters to see how far he can go. He says it's Putin's dream for Russia to be treated as a superpower dealing one-on-one with the American president over the heads of the Europeans.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Kyiv. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty is suing the United States Agency for Global Media after it pulled grants that fund the broadcaster. The Czech Republic-based news organization argues the Trump administration is not abiding by Congress's power of the purse, and it names officials, including the acting CEO of the Agency for Global Media, Carrie Lake. She says this is about cost-cutting. To discuss the suit and what's at stake here, I'm joined in studio by Steve Kappas, the president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Layla.
So I want to, before we get to the lawsuit, I just want to give people a sense of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which has broadcast for 75 years. You share news in 27 languages to nearly two dozen autocratic countries with limited or no press freedoms like Russia. Now, Steve, when your funding was cut over the weekend, you called it a massive gift to America's enemies. Why a gift?
Because we're a lifeline to the people who live in those countries, and they have no access to information outside of largely government propaganda and other types of information like that. So we're leaving the information battlefield, if you will, to these countries like Iran, like China, all over our coverage area, by the way, Russia. And so at a time when there's so much happening in the world, think about what's the report we just listened to from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Think about what's going on in the Middle East. All of the U.S. international broadcasters, including Radio Free Europe and Voice of America, are threatened. VOA has gone silent.
Right. It's been replaced by music. What's the argument you're making in court?
Simply put, this was an unlawful act. USAGM does not have the ability to go around Congress. Congress has appropriated our funds. It's very clearly laid out in the budget, and we expect our funding. USAGM is simply in the position to administer a grant of congressionally appropriated funds.
Now, can you keep going without U.S. funding? As you pointed out, the Voice of America has been shuttered. There's been cuts to other private broadcasters like Radio Free Asia.
It's going to be tough. I mean, this is part of the reason why we went to court. We're living off of our savings right now, and we're in a position where we're going to have to take some pretty drastic actions in the not-too-distant future. Our audiences are already feeling the impact of the VOA shutdown, or even USAGM. They've turned off transmitters. So our audiences inside Iran, and we reach 10% of the Iranian audience on average every week, 6.5 million people. Those people have lost a significant part of their feeds, their radio feeds, because the USAGM transmitters have gone dark. That's what we're hearing from thousands of our normal audience members.
Now, you're based in Prague, and this week the Czech foreign minister asked the European Union to fill the gap in your funding. Can Europe fill the gap?
Well, we're immensely gratified that so many European nations have stepped up and said that they value this service. We've been around for 75 years. We've been in their neighborhoods, and they understand why it's necessary to stand up against Russia and China and Iran's growing malign influence all across the region, our investigative reports, things like that. They understand the value. Can they step up and fill the funding gap? We haven't gone forward to ask them that. We've been, for 75 years, we've looked to Congress to receive our funds, and we want to get this resolved. But if it comes to it, then we'll be looking at alternatives, and we have no choice. We can't let this vital institution go silent.
Well, let me ask about that. If you don't win in court, what happens to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and your journalists, including five journalists you have jailed in autocratic nations for their work?
I hate to think about it, because these people, think about it, they're being held in Russia, in Iran, in Crimea, Russian-controlled Crimea. They're being held in Azerbaijan and Belarus. Why do you think the leadership there is so threatened by our people? They're thrown into prison and because they want to silence us. This is the dedication of our people, and this is what's at risk. Those governments don't want us in there. I think whenever anybody wants to silence us, we should speak up.
Steve Kappas is the president and CEO of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Two NASA astronauts are back on Earth after an extended stay on the International Space Station. Their mission was set to last only 8 days, but Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams ended up spending 9 months in orbit. Central Florida Public Media's Brendan Byrne has more on the astronauts' 286 days in space.
It was a picture-perfect return as the SpaceX Dragon capsule gently splashed down under a canopy of four parachutes just off the coast of Tallahassee, Florida.
And splashdown. Crew 9 back on Earth.
But their mission wasn't as smooth as their return. NASA astronauts Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams arrived at the station back in June in Boeing's Starliner spacecraft designed to take astronauts to and from the station. It was a test flight. But during their arrival, the crew encountered problems with the spacecraft's thrusters. Starliner docked successfully, but NASA decided it wasn't safe enough to take them home. Instead, they went with another company, Elon Musk's SpaceX, for the return journey. Starliner was sent back to Earth without a crew in August, and an already planned crew mission flew to the station in September with only two of its four seats taken by NASA's Nick Haig and Russia's Alexander Gorbunov. The empty seats were for Wilmore and Williams. The four returned home together.
Nick, Alex, Butch, Sonny, on behalf of SpaceX, welcome home.
During their extended stay, Wilmore and Williams became part of the station crew, conducting 150 unique science experiments and multiple spacewalks. NASA's Steve Stitch says despite the mission not going as originally planned,
Butch and Sonny's return on Dragon to me shows how important it is to have two different crew transportation systems.
NASA says Boeing is committed to flying Starliner again, although when that will happen and whether or not it will carry a crew is still unclear. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Morning Edition here on KAXE, KBXE Wednesday Morning Show. My name is Andrew DeZingle, and in just a bit, I'm going to be joined by Jen Kellen, and we are going to be here until 9 o'clock, and then we're going to hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and music from around the world on KAXE 7 days a week. Friends and community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. We receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company powering the region's homes, businesses, and industries since 1923. Learn more about its vision of a carbon-free future at mnpower.com/energyforward. The AARP Foundation Tax Aid Program is providing free income tax preparation for people over the age of 50 or those with modest income at the Bemidji Senior Center now through April 14th. They are available for walk-in appointments on a first-come, first-served basis Monday, Thursdays, and Fridays from 9 to 1. Now we'll take you back to Morning Edition here on member-supported KAXE KBXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. From Progressive, Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faudel.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A famous photo from 1895 is the basis for many posters and the occasional social media meme. It shows an old-fashioned steam locomotive that couldn't stop, crashed all the way through a railroad terminal, and tumbled out onto the street on the far side. The novelist Emma Donoghue saw that photo. Her earlier novels include Room, which is the story of a mother and child trapped in a room, which became a film. Now Donoghue's novel, The Paris Express, tries to imagine what life was like for travelers on that train in 1895.
An express train set off from Granville on the Normandy coast and headed straight for Paris. It was only meant to stop four times along the route, and it was meant to get in by 4 o'clock. And it all went horribly wrong, Steve. There were some important guests on the train, you know, VIPs. There were three members of parliament. And one of them asked, could the train possibly stop near his country house for his carriage to be put on? And that delayed the train by 10 minutes, which was enough to bring on disaster because the driver and stoker, the entire crew, would have felt under massive pressure to get to Paris on time despite this delay.
This would have counted, I think, as a minor train accident and not remembered to history at all, except for a particular photograph.
You're so right. In fact, it's a cluster of photographs. Lots of people rushed to the scene of the disaster and took pictures, amateurs as well as professionals. But all of them show an incongruous image of a train plunging out a window almost vertically. I don't know how I hadn't come across it in half a century, maybe because I never was in residence at a university and it's a very popular dorm room image. But basically, it's that combination of modernity and high tech and really impressive signs of industry and speed. And then complete disasters.
You said that you, until recently, were not familiar with this image as a poster and a bit of pop culture. So what got you interested in the story?
I happened to be going to live in the area of Montparnasse in Paris for a year because my partner is a French professor. That was the only place we could find a three-bedroom flat for us and our large children. I Googled it, and the first thing I saw was multiple copies of this photograph from 1895. And I just thought, that's the most arresting image I've ever seen. And I looked it up and thought, why has nobody written a novel about this?
Now, you could have made up everything except the final image, but you seem instead to have done a bunch of research. How did you go about learning about this?
You know, I find the facts are often more amazingly strange than anything I could make up. I research things really very much as if I'm doing solid history. You know, I use databases, I use newspapers. I was able to look up a wonderful hoard of bureaucracy. But then there always comes a moment when the facts run out. So I enjoy making stuff up just as much.
When you're making stuff up, I'm interested in this detail. Sometimes writers of historical fiction will say, I make stuff up that is consistent with the historical record, that could have happened even if nobody knows that it did. Do you try that?
Yes. For instance, I didn't have an individual coffee seller person to use on my train, but I spotted in a photograph in the Paris Historical Museum, I spotted an amazing image of somebody wearing a gigantic tank on their back full of hot coffee, which he served out of little taps on his chest. And I thought, okay, that is clearly credible for the time to have a human coffee pot serving the busy commuters. And what a modern image.
When you began learning about some of the passengers on the train, what are some of the kinds of people you found?
We all know that on a train, there's going to be a vivid example of the class system because people are literally segregated into nice red velvet covered carriages in first class and then horrible cramped carriages in third class. But I also found diversity in other ways because France was the center of its own empire, right? So you've got Cambodian students, you've North African coffee sellers, you've expats, American painters visiting like Henry Ossawa Tanner. You have troublemakers and anarchists and lowlifes visiting Paris. You have inventors, you have writers, you have queers, you have feminists.
Well, let's remember what railroads were doing in the 1800s when they were the hot new technology. How were they changing society?
Well, for instance, on my train, the local makers of Camembert, they were able to ship their cheeses across the world before the cheeses got too stinky. So suddenly, your man and woman in a village in Normandy could ship their cheeses to New York, and that meant they could actually stay in their village and they could make money there. So it had a huge influence on the settlement patterns, emigration patterns. Trains were astonishingly central to the shaping of Europe. It was the perfect vehicle for a novel because a train moves from beginning to end with unexpected events along the way, just like a novel.
And I think you're right that it's transforming commerce, but also communication, but also society and where people live and how people work and essentially everything.
Oh, and time, for instance. Suddenly you had to have standardized time zones because the trains were the first things that could, you know, whiz from one state in America to another fast enough that they might actually collide with each other if they weren't working on the same time. So suddenly people had to start standardizing their watches.
Did the experience of writing this book change the way that you thought about the next time you were checking email or doing something online or whatever you were doing in modern times?
You know, writing this book didn't turn me into a Luddite, but it certainly helped me think in a very practical way about the costs of our technology and our longing to get there faster and easier and smoother. The ideal of the frictionless life, it's always based on somebody else's hard labor.
If it didn't turn you into a Luddite, what did it do? Just make you try to appreciate all the unseen parts of our lives?
Yes, and be aware that you can make decisions. I mean, you know, one of the reasons the train crashed is, I would say, the big railway companies, they had an implicit policy of, yeah, go ahead and speed. You know, in theory, the drivers weren't meant to speed, but the company was like, we'll give you all a good big bonus if you get to Paris on time, despite delays, you know, and any delays caused by the passengers. Can you make up that time, please? It also made me think a lot about my own mortality, actually, because the train, again, starts to seem like an image of a human life. You know, you think you have all the way till Paris, but there can be an interruption and a derailment at any moment.
I am thinking of the popular internet phrase, move fast and break things, which has been repeated a lot recently because of Elon Musk's actions in Washington. This train was moving fast and breaking things. And you note the historical fact that the crew was in no way particularly punished for the crash.
No. These were just seen as the costs of doing business, to use another cliche.
Emma Donoghue is the author of The Paris Express, her latest novel. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
The pleasure has been all mine, Steve. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
In 2022, the Chinese government told NPR's Emily Fang she was no longer welcome in China, where she had lived and reported for 7 years. Even so, she says she hasn't lost claim to her Chinese identity.
Being Chinese is not confined to the boundaries of the People's Republic of China.
I'm Elsa Chang. My conversation with NPR's Emily Fang on her new book, Let Only Red Flowers Bloom, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can hear All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 p.m. with your local host, Jennifer Barr. Good morning. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Jen Kellen. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. How about you?
I'm doing great. It is Wednesday morning.
It is.
It's a beautiful morning.
It is.
The sun's starting to come up. We're seeing that little dark blue in the back.
I just saw that over my shoulder. Isn't that the prettiest color? I just love that in the morning.
It is a very pretty color.
It's good. It's clear skies, mild temperatures. Are you, I know the answer to this question. You're not a maple syrup tapper?
No, I don't. I wouldn't know a maple syrup
tap if it walked up and tapped you on your shoulder. Yeah. You a maple syrup fan?
Yeah. Okay. I'll put it on French toast. I'll put it on pancakes.
Waffles.
I don't really like waffles, to be honest with you.
Even though they have extra maple syrup holding capacity.
See, that does nothing for me.
Really?
I like a little bit of maple syrup and spread it around.
Okay.
On a pancake
you're
or
not
French toast, but I'm not like drowning it in maple syrup.
You're not looking for a little pool of syrup with a bite of a waffle?
No, I don't need that.
You don't need
I don't like French toast sticks either, to be honest. We had them at our school for breakfast in the morning.
Yeah.
Never a fan.
I am old enough. I'm older than French toast sticks. We did not have those at my school. We didn't even have breakfast at school.
You didn't even have breakfast?
No,
wow.
That's how old I am. We just had French toast over the weekend. I forget about French toast, but I always enjoy it when I have it. But I don't cut it into stick shapes.
Do you put butter on?
Absolutely.
On French toast?
Oh, yeah.
And pancakes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love butter on pancakes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a must.
It's a must.
Yeah. You go butterless with your French toast?
Yeah, I never have butter on my French toast.
Really?
I'll put butter on pancakes, but never on French toast. I didn't even think about the idea of putting it on French toast.
I invite you to try it next time. Yep. I don't think you'll go back.
I don't know when next time I'll have French toast, to be honest with you.
Well, why not tonight? We're talking about it. We got your supper planned.
All right. Are you a syrup person?
Maybe people, how many people right now are drizzling syrup on something?
Do you put syrup on everything?
Oatmeal?
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Cream of wheat? Have you ever had cream of wheat?
No.
No?
I was thinking of, what's that cereal?
Malt meal?
No. The one where it's like shredded wheat and like frosting on it.
Oh,
frosted mini wheats.
Mini wheats.
There we go.
Yeah.
I've had that.
You would not want to put syrup on that.
Why not?
So sweet. Curl your teeth.
Well, maybe.
Yikes. It'd be like.
I think you're overestimating how the frosting on a frosted mini wheat.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've. Yeah, I don't remember the last time I had that. Isn't it really crunchy? I mean...
Oh, yeah, it's crunchy.
The wheat itself is crunchy, kind of like a big straw bale. And then the frosting... Don't they remind... Did you ever have those?
I haven't eaten a lot of straw bales, but if I had to, maybe. Yeah. I feel like it would be tougher to eat than a frosted mini wheat, but...
than a straw bale.
I'll take your word.
I haven't eaten... I've watched... Well, animals don't eat straw. They eat hay, but... the color of shredded wheat is much more straw-like than hay-like.
That's true.
Anyway.
Are you tapping the trees for maple syrup?
Text us
at 218-326-1234. We'd love to hear from you.
Should be a perfect week weather-wise, I think.
Yeah, and speaking of weather, we're going to have the Beltrami County Master Gardeners joining us, but we're talking about... Not outdoor plants, but indoor plants.
Indoor plants.
Your house plants.
That's a good thing to take care of while we wait for it to just kind of round the corner. Spring's on its way, but it's a little early.
Yep, we almost got fooled into thinking it was spring last week. And then the snow came this weekend.
Yes, that was an abrupt one too. What was it, 64 degrees on Friday and then snowing on Saturday.
Yep.
That's March.
And not the good kind of snow, like freezing snow.
Yeah, heavy wet cement snow. But it could have been worse.
And then later in the today's show, we're going to be talking with, well, I'll be talking with the... Heartland Symphony Orchestra Youth Concerto Competition winners and talking about their performances going on this weekend.
Where are they out of?
The winners are from Bemidji, but the Heartland Symphony Orchestra is in Brainerd and Little Falls.
Okay, very good.
And they'll be playing a tune, a world premiere of a new piece of music written by I forget his name, okay. Ian Jones, I think.
Okay.
But it's a piece inspired by Radiohead, so we're going to be hearing a Radiohead tune later this morning in honor of that.
Very good. I'm looking forward to hearing that.
And we're here until 9 o'clock, and then we're going to hand things over to Kari Hedlund for Headwaters. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, contact us at 218-326-1234 during business hours. The board's full meeting schedule is available online at kaxe.org.
We receive support from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of First Call for Help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resources to the residents of any age who are in crisis. Available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211.
Time now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A project bringing solar energy to the Wind River Reservation has hit some road bumps due to pauses in federal funding. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports, the team's searching for other ways to move forward.
Energize Wind River is poised to set up standalone solar systems and bring electricity to roughly 40 Eastern Shoshone homes. But
the but would be that our construction funding is currently on hold pending review.
That's project director Levi Purdom. He says about $2 million of funding is paused. Even though the project has funding for training, employees, and outreach, it's unable to buy or install the solar equipment. Purdom is optimistic that the funding will eventually come through. But for now, the group secured a $20,000 grant from the Nature Conservancy.
They wanted to support our non-governmental fundraising efforts. So the intent is to hire and fund a fundraising specialist.
Energize Wind River still plans to start construction this spring if they're able to raise enough money. Other tribal nations across the Mountain West are facing similar issues amid budget cuts by the Trump administration. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Marine species like salmon and humpback whales might be becoming more frequent fixtures in the Arctic, especially as sea ice becomes less reliable from climate change. For residents in Alaska's most northern communities, it can mean changes to subsistence. The shifts in migration are also fascinating scientists. KNBA's Alaska Desk reporter Alona Nyden has more.
Catching salmon in the North Slope village of Kaktovik was unheard of not too long ago. But as resident Robert Thompson says, some fishermen now see salmon more regularly. About 5 years ago, Thompson caught a dozen salmon, a small but noticeable number, he says.
Before it was unusual and people would talk about it, but if somebody got a salmon, but now it's fairly common.
Fishermen, hunters, and researchers gathered at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage back in January to discuss changing migration patterns of several fish species and marine animals. One of the conference presenters was Elizabeth Mika Clindley, a graduate student from Bethel who grew up fishing for salmon. For a year, Lindley and other researchers tracked temperatures in the Anaktuvik River, which runs through gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve.
The temperature conditions, it seems like they are survivable.
Less ice might also mean new territory for humpback whales. Oceanographer Kate Stafford says data from local whalers and aerial surveys points to more humpbacks visiting the Chukchi Sea in recent years. In Utqiagvik, humpbacks were sighted only twice before 2021 and 2 to 3 times in years after that. Then, last fall, researchers saw more than 25 whales feeding close together for 2 days in a row.
We came across what I would call humpback palooza.
Utqiagvik whaler Michael Donovan says he did not witness the humpback palooza, but he has seen a few humpbacks during his fall hunts. He says that he and other whalers are worried that humpbacks might be competing for krill and copepods with bowheads, the staple subsistence resource in his community.
Well, definitely they're an invasive species. You know, they come in and eat the same food that our bowheads eat.
Donovan and other hunters say they're supportive of scientists collecting data on whales other than bowheads, which are growing their presence in warming waters in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Nyden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kohanic Broadcast Corporation, funded by the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew Dzingel, and coming up in a bit, we're going to be hearing about the Texas smuggling verdict, NYC COVID delivery workers, and Aurelio Martinez remembrance. That'll be coming up in just a bit. I'm Andrew Dzingel here with Jen Kellen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Now the sun's starting to come up. It's getting bluer every time I look out the window.
Yeah, beautiful.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you for listening this morning. Hope your morning's off to a good start.
Yeah, so our question of the week this week is, tell us about a time luck was on your side. Are you feeling lucky today, Jen?
How could you not?
Really?
It's Wednesday. It's Wednesday, right? Yeah, actually, I am feeling lucky tonight because we have leftovers for supper.
Oh.
Leftovers make me feel, I think that's the greatest.
What is it, French toast?
No, that's gone. It is a new, like, sesame, it was a sheet pan sesame meatball with snap peas and bell peppers.
Wow. So do you put, like, a sauce on top of that?
Yeah, there was a soy sauce kind of. I can't do hand motions on the radio, can I?
Do you put it on a bed of, like, rice or anything?
Yes,
or does the peas serve as the rice?
No.
Gotcha.
No, you got to serve rice with it, too. It was delicious.
It sounds delicious.
The recipe was inadvertently doubled, and so we have leftovers.
Nice.
And, you know, having a 15-year-old in the house, sometimes when you double a recipe, there are no leftovers. And if the recipe's really big, like this one was, you get lucky and you have some leftovers left, so...
Mm-hmm.
I think we can squeak two meals out of it.
But you've never won, like, a raffle or anything like that?
Nope.
Never?
Never.
Do you try? What about bingo?
Yes, I do try. I have one of my aunt wins everything, mm-hmm. and she does the trick where she'll fill out her name and phone number, and then she scrunches up the thing and puts it in the box or the barrel or whatever. Have you heard about this technique? Yeah. And she wins everything. And so I was like, oh, that's all you have to do. Scrunch it up. Put it in.
I knew a guy who would put a little bit of soda pop on a piece of paper so it's a little sticky.
Yeah.
So when they reach in, it'll, like, stick to their hand.
Yeah. Is that really luck, though, then? Seems like you're
making your own luck.
You got your finger on the scale, it sounds like. What about you? When has luck been on your side?
One time on my birthday, I went to the casino and I went to a slot machine.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't realize it, but I accidentally pressed max bet. So that's like $2.
Oh, wow.
Maybe even more.
High stakes.
But then I won the bonus.
So you won $4.
So I won $200.
No way, really?
Yeah.
How exciting was that?
It was super exciting because it was my birthday.
Yeah. So... did you take the money and run, or did you keep playing?
I played maybe like a little bit more, but I definitely left with $200.
Okay, good. Good job.
Yeah, it was a fun day.
That is.
I was with my parents, too.
Yeah?
And it was just like on the way home back to Bemidji, and just like, well, let's stop here and then...
and see what happens.
Yep, and then something happened.
Lady Luck showed up is what happened.
I've also won on a scratch ticket once, won $200 on one of those.
Wow.
And then recently on Pull Tabs, won $400.
Wow. Wow, I had no idea. And yet, the office dollar that we bet back and forth... stays firmly in your desk drawer.
Yeah, because I'm lucky. I'd rather be lucky than good.
Yeah, that's true. That's for me, too. Me, too. Anybody else out there that has any luck stories that they'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear about them. Text in 218-326-1234. And we'd like to let you know that we receive support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special order pricing and more at drinkdragonfly.com. Support also comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Now more from Morning Edition.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. A federal jury in San Antonio says two men are guilty for their roles in the deaths of 53 migrants, including six children. It was the deadliest human smuggling incident in modern U.S. history. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flab reports on Tuesday's verdict.
Felipe Orduña Torres and Armando Gonzalez Ortega face the rest of their life in prison for the deaths that took place in the back of a tractor trailer without air conditioning in the South Texas sun. The men were both found guilty of all charges ranging from smuggling the people into the country to the overarching conspiracy that resulted in the migrants' injuries or deaths. Migrants dying while being smuggled into the country have been found many times throughout the past decade, but this was especially egregious, says San Antonio immigration attorney Jonathan Ryan.
It remains the largest single casualty event of its type in Texas and potentially in the United States. That is in terms of those who have been discovered.
The men are part of an international smuggling operation, federal prosecutors say. Five others have already been convicted or pleaded guilty, also facing potential life sentences. The case showed a vast network of human smuggling crossing multiple countries that have spurred other investigations and international indictments. After the verdict, federal prosecutor Eric Fuchs showed images from inside the sealed tractor trailer to reporters showing claw marks.
Claw marks from when they were desperately clawing at the sides, trying to get out. You could see that insulation, the scraps of it, and how it's fresh right below the claw marks.
The people who died came from Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. The tractor trailer in which they were found came from Laredo, Texas. 11 people survived the devastating trip and are still in the United States with the opportunity to apply for U visas, which are given to non-citizens who are victims of some crimes. Orduña Torres and Gonzalez Ortega will be sentenced June 27th. I'm Paul Flavin, San Antonio.
The 65,000 delivery workers in New York City, deliveristas, became essential workers in the early days of the pandemic. WNYC's Arun Venugopal looks back 5 years later.
The other day, Gustavo Akje sat outside the New York Stock Exchange. Tourists from around the world were milling about, taking pictures in front of the statue known as Fearless Girl.
This is my area.
Akje is the founder of Los Deliveristas Unidos. The group represents workers who deliver the meals that New Yorkers order via DoorDash and other apps. He says just thinking about Manhattan 5 years ago when the city streets were desolate makes him sad.
Because most of the time during the pandemic, like at 3 or 4 p.m., this street was so quiet, you're not seeing nobody.
No one except for delivery workers. The vast majority are immigrants, and they kept bringing New Yorkers their meals and medications on e-bikes and mopeds. It wasn't easy. The streets were eerily quiet, and delivery workers were vulnerable to assault and robbery. So they formed WhatsApp groups to stay in touch with each other.
They say, hey, you okay? Yes, I just dropped the food on my way back. Okay, you're safe.
But Akje felt the rest of the city was hardly giving the workers much thought. If you lived through the pandemic in New York, you might have leaned out your window every evening and banged a pan for essential workers. This was Harlem in April of 2020.
Every time New Yorkers will come out of the doors to clap, they will mention every worker who was in the front line except deliveristas.
Ligia Hualpa runs the Workers' Justice Project and joined forces with Akje early in the pandemic. They fought to improve pay and safety for delivery workers and help New Yorkers understand this is essential work. Hualpa's voice cracked as she told the story of one worker who delivered a case of water through heavy rain. The ride took 30 minutes and paid $4. No tip. By the time he arrived, Hualpa says he was exhausted and furious.
And when somebody opened the door, it was an old lady on a wheelchair. And he said, at that moment, I cried because I was like, I'm helping somebody that cannot get access to basic services. And he said, at that moment, I understood what my role was.
The efforts to initiate change began to pay off. In 2021, the workers secured a raft of city laws improving their pay and working conditions. And last month, DoorDash agreed to pay nearly $17 million to settle claims that it withheld tips meant for thousands of delivery workers. A DoorDash spokesperson said the settlement was related to an old pay model that's since been retired. But Hualpa says the results have been validating.
It's a beautiful story that explains the power that a small grassroots organizing group has built in the city of New York.
Gustavo Akje says he's proud of what's been achieved since the pandemic and that delivery workers are not done fighting. For NPR News, I'm Arun Venugopal in New York.
Music fans from around the world are remembering Honduran folk musician Aurelio Martinez. He died this week in a plane crash near the Honduran island of Roatan. 11 others also died.
That's so beautiful. Martinez grew up in a remote area of northern Honduras. He moved to the port city of La Ceiba at the age of 14 to study music and eventually launched his performing career alongside Belizean musician Andy Palacio.
Martinez was called an ambassador of Garifuna music. It's a blend of reggae, Latin, and calypso. Here he is at his NPR Tiny Desk concert in 2015 explaining the cultures and influences that make up Garifuna music.
Garifuna music is a special music. This culture comes from a special mix with African people and Arawak Indian in the Caribbean island in St. Vincent. From this mix come from a new culture, Garifuna culture, Garifuna community. Welcome to Garifuna Nation.
In 2005, Martinez took a break from performing to become the first Afro-Honduran elected to the country's National Congress. But he left politics after a few short years to return to his true love, making music. That included international tours, Garifuna songwriting workshops for kids, and three more studio albums.
Last year, one of those releases, Landini, was named one of the best Latin American albums of all time by music journalists from the region. Aurelio Martinez was 55 years old. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Morning Edition here from National Public Radio here on member-supported KAXC, KBXC. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Jen Kellen, and coming up at 7:01, it's going to be the Up North Report, local news from our region.
We received support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtCenter.org.
And in about an hour and 20 minutes, we're going to have the Beltrami County Master Gardeners joining us for our monthly segment, Twist and Sprout, where they give us advice on plant-related stuff.
Yeah.
And this month, we're talking houseplants, so that'll be exciting.
Very good. What do you think they'll say about the houseplants and the studio plants that
I
we have here?
I only assume they would say good things. They're thriving in here. Look at them.
They look great. They look very happy.
It's so green in that corner.
And we could get some advice about those dumb canes in the glass.
Yeah, we got to get them
in a pot.
Pots, two
maybe,
of them.
Yeah. Maybe they'll be able to help us.
Yeah, but they seem to be doing even better without a pot, so I don't know.
They have far exceeded the size of that pint glass, though.
Well, they got way more leaves than the one that's in a pot.
The roots that they've put out in that glass, if you pick them up, it's just like glass-shaped. They're kind of going around and around, but I can't argue with it. They look very happy, so.
Yeah.
Maybe we should pot one and leave one in the glass, see what happens.
We're going to need a bigger glass.
Yeah, we are. Yes, we are.
And coming up in a bit, we're going to be hearing a tune from Radiohead, so that'll be exciting.
Yeah, just not any tune, though. Or you're not
talking about... No, it is
about,
just any tune.
Oh, okay, you're not talking about the Symphony Orchestra Kids.
I'm playing a Radiohead song because of the Symphony,
okay.
But it's not the one that's based on what they're going to play at the Symphony.
Okay.
We'll talk about that in a bit.
I thought you were giving a little teaser for the Area Voices interview later.
Oh, I wish I was. So this past Friday, it was Pi Day, and we had a little gathering here at the KBXE studio and at the KXE studio in Grand Rapids.
Yeah.
And it was a great turnout.
It was fantastic. I think it was just a fabulous day. People just kept pouring in. We had lots of different types of pie to share with people. What did you get in on? It went fast. I mean, we had great turnout.
I only got one slice of pie.
Me too. Just a little sliver. And it was just because I was trying to cut, you know, the first piece of pie is always hard.
Yeah, that's what I did. I just cut out the first slice so that people would
dig in.
Yep, and they did.
They did. Yeah, and you made how many pots of coffee for the crowd?
I made
here?
6 pots of coffee at least.
Yeah.
So people were buzzing.
They were. And people stayed and chatted, and it was just great time to see people.
Yeah, it was a great time.
Thank you so much for swinging in if you did, and if you missed it this time, hopefully we'll do another one. You can swing by.
Yeah, so let us know. What kind of a gathering events would you like to see?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Text us at 218-326-1234.
What do you think? We did pie day. What do you think about a bar day? Are you a fan of a bar for dessert?
I love bars.
Do you? Do you have a favorite?
Does brownies count?
I think so.
I love a scotcheroo.
Yeah, that's a classic. Brownies, do you like brownies to be frosted?
No, I just like them. Okay. Just straight up brownie.
Do you do a little sprinkle of powdered sugar?
No.
Okay. All right.
It's a mess.
Except if your dog licks the powdered sugar.
Yeah, apparently.
Which happened to my mom one time. See, my great grandma's brownie recipe, no frosting, but powdered sugar on the top.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I grew up with because my grandma made it. My mom made it. And then when I got married, Dave grew up with brownies with frosting. So we had to, you know, combine those two things.
And how was that for you?
I conceded to the frosted brownie. If brownies aren't my favorite. He likes brownies.
What's your favorite bar then?
It depends.
Pumpkin bar?
Well, it depends on the time of year. Yeah, if it's fall, pumpkin bar with cream cheese frosting. Mm-hmm. For sure. This time of year, lemon bar.
Lemon bar.
Also with powdered sugar.
Mm.
You made a face.
I don't like lemon bar.
Yeah, that's what your face said.
Yeah.
Not a fan?
No, I'm not a big lemon guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What about lemon drops candy? Do you like that?
Not really. I mean, I'll have one.
Oh, I'll have them.
I haven't had a lemon drop for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You still get a lemon drop?
Oh, yeah.
Can you?
Yeah.
Where would you go right now to buy a lemon drop if you had to? Fleet?
Maybe they have them at, like, Walgreens type
okay,
places.
Yeah, I suppose. Drugstore candy kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah.
So, what's your favorite bar? Text us at 218-326-1234. We'd love to hear from you. And,
Support comes from KXE. Our support for KXE comes from the Grassroots Concert Series, presenting Morning Bird on Friday, April 4th at 7:30 p.m. at the Live Well Nightclub and Coffee Bar in Nisswa. Doors open at 6:30. The full spring lineup can be found at grassrootsconcerts.org.
Now we're going to hear a bit of Radiohead here on the Wednesday Morning Show. This is House of Cards.